Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello and welcome to episode 110 of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello, sir, for the 110th time.
Indeed. Tonight we look at I Saw the Devil, a title which has long been on my watch pile, and we finally have brought it to the show after putting it up for several Halloween votes, and we decided it was long overdue that we finally got around to watching it, and that's what we'd be covering on tonight's episode. Since the last episode, I don't know about yourself, but I've actually watched quite a few things, so we've got a fair bit to talk about this one. So,
I've only got 1.5 things. My suspicion is one of my half is something that you've watched. So okay. I'm just going to talk about the one. And then I think we'll cover the other half on the other side. And if not, so be it. But I'm pretty certain because I've looked at your letterboxed. Inspired by I Saw the Devil, even though I've seen that before, but inspired about cleaning out our watch pile, I watched a movie I've not only owned on DVD like forever, but I bought on iTunes like back in the day when buying movies on iTunes was a thing, which I haven't.
It's surprising how many people still use iTunes, because I thought it was like this derelict thing, but it is actually one of our biggest platforms when you look at the numbers, because I thought, you know, everyone's on Spotify or streaming things, but you know, there are people out there who still use iTunes.
I do for music. I really haven't gone into the streaming world. I still buy CDs. I still buy things on iTunes. I'm utterly committed to that sort of Apple infrastructure. But movies and TV shows, everything I mostly had was either stuff like, it used to be how I used to get review copies of Shaw Brother movies was through iTunes codes when a lot of them were on iTunes. And like at Christmas, Apple always used to do like a 25 days worth of Christmas thing. And in that, there'd always be like a free movie or TV show. So my library is filled with these things I'll never watch. However, I did spend good money on Hirokazu Koreeda's Air Doll. Director Koreeda that is really, really popular and well thought of, and we haven't touched his stuff at all. I know things like Shoplifter's got a lot of traction. But yeah, and he's not a director I've really watched a lot of, so I thought, you know what, I'm finally going to watch Air Doll, especially as I think we were speaking about Bay Du Nar. Oh, I know why. On another show we were talking about Bay Du Nar, and it just sort of made me think about, oh, I must watch it. So Air Doll, what is Air Doll? Air Doll is described variously as some kind of like erotic Pinocchio, and I think that's pushing it a bit. Basically, Bay Du Nar. So it's a Japanese film, although Bay Du Nar is a Korean actress. She is a inflatable sex doll that one day comes to life. And so she's an inflatable sex doll of this sort of lonely man who's clearly split up with his girlfriend. And he has a very intimate, not just sexual relationship with this doll. And by the way, mate, it's like a blow-up doll, not like one of these real dolls or anything. It's not like Lars and the real girl.
This is sounding like Mannequin.
Yeah. So, well, yes, yeah, it goes other places. But but yeah, just, you know, it's one of those blow-up dolls with one of those faces, you know. This is not like a real doll kind of thing. However, she comes to life one day, basically has a heart. And whilst he's out at work, she goes out and experiences the world and ends up getting a job at a video store and ends up learning about life. And then at night she'll go home and be a sex doll again. She also falls in love with a younger guy, and I'm just careful what to say without spoiling it. But she is still a sex doll, right? She even when she's sort of in a human mode, one time she cuts herself, and because she's a blow up doll, all the air releases out of her body, and she just becomes a collapsed thing on the floor. So her nature becomes known to a couple of other people. But basically, it's like this high concept sort of Pinocchio's type story where this girl, you know, this doll has become real. And being a Japanese, the Kurita's sort of an art house director, it doesn't go in anywhere particularly grim. It's more a story about, not grim or sexy. It's not that. There's boobs and stuff, but I wouldn't say it's very erotic, mate. But it's fascinating and it's really, really good. And Bae Doon-ah is fucking excellent. And it's really sad at the end. it's really horribly sad, and it gets quite sort of gruesome and then tragic. But I, you know, it's taken me, I mean, it came out in 2009. I must have had it on my watch list for the last 13 years. And I'm really glad I finally got around to watching it. It was really cool. So, yeah, I'd recommend it highly if you're fascinated by that. But don't think of it as a sort of like a pervy sex comedy. It's certainly not that kind of thing. And it's certainly a million times better than Mannequin. What about yourself? I think you've got a litany of things.
Okay, it's all over the place, so, you know, strap in for this one. First off, we have a film which, on the outset, will make me wonder why I'm talking about this show, but that's Cannonball Run 2.
Is that because Jackie Chan's in it?
It has got Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan was also in the first one.
Yeah, I'm just thinking...
More interesting... Though this is a cross promotion, this is another Golden Harvest cross promotion projects.
Yes,
because they did a series of projects for Chan and Cannonball. The Cannonball Run movies, you had Battle Creek Brawl and you had The Protector, and obviously it didn't really work out, and he went obviously back to Hong Kong and continue being a mega star over there, and will later try and tackle America again when we had Russia. But no, I really like Cannonball Run 2. I think it's far superior to the first Cannonball Run. I don't know if you've seen any of these movies. They were kind of like staples of like ITV viewing back when I was a kid.
So. I've seen them both numerous times. I could not tell you really what happened in either of them or separate them apart. But they're in that they were on ITV twice a year on a sort of either a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday night, so, you know, things would like, they'd be on, and those Clint Eastwood movies with the orangutan, Every Which Way But Loose, and
that's right,
those kind of absolutely harmless movies, as far as I can say. They're probably a bit of their time. You're probably going to tell me there's some horrible racist and misogyny and bad taste jokes in them, but on the whole, sort of quite star-filled, Dukes of Hazzardy, that kind of.
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of like classic 80s sort of car smash movies.
Yeah.
As you said, right, these are like star-studded vehicles for the time. A lot, when you look at the reviews, a lot of people are like saying, oh, these are like stars trying to like prop up their flagging careers. But for myself, when I was watching it, it was always like the who's who of it. The fact that you got like Donna Louise and Burt Reynolds, who I was very excited about. You've got Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. And in the second one, you also have Frank Sinatra. And as I said, Richard, in the second, Jackie Chan's in both of them. In the second one, he's teamed up with Jaws from the Bond movies.
Richard Kiel.
Richard Kiel, well, which is just an interesting ironic, double act in itself.
Because I watched The Spy Who Loved Me this week. Also starring Richard Kiel.
So, yeah, and I mean, when you watch the first one as well, you've got Johnny Yuna turns up as a talk show host in one of Chan's like segments in there. And he would go on to do the movies They Call Me Bruce and They Still Call Me Bruce, which is like basically him sending up his own heritage, really. He's sort of like really playing up like sort of like Chinese stereotypes. And I think it's one that At some point, we may do as like a bonus show or something just to look at those movies. Because there's a couple of movies, including another film that I saw this week, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But yeah, it's as I said, these are just really fun movies, and I think especially with Cannonball Run 2, it's sort of like really sort of nails down the formula. As I said, it's just like cool vehicles and people getting sort of slack fu brawls and stuff.
At the risk of this show going off the rails, I've just remembered, like Smokey and the Bandit, that's another one. It's Burt Reynolds kind of movies, or Convoy with Chris Christopherson. These were the films
I
that
watched Convoy for the first time the other day, and it's so good.
I need to watch it. I used to love like Rubber Duck and all that, and I used to love the theme song. That must be, I guess that was Chris Christopherson.
Yes,
yeah.
C.W. McCall, who did the song Convoy, which then got turned into the film Convoy.
That's
with
right.
Chris
yeah,
Christopherson
I have
playing
to say,
a trucker, which
you are making me vaguely nostalgic for a sort of film I didn't remember being nostalgic for, but
Well, in the first one, we also have Michael Hui, who's in a bunch of Jackie Chan movies, such as like Robin Be Good.
right, yes, Robin B. Hood, yeah.
Yeah, Robin Be Hood, sorry. So it's kind of astounding when you like look at the casting. But yeah, as I said, with the second one, it's sort of like you see the stuff that Chan's doing. He's got the great physical comedy. He gets to do some like fun fight scenes. I mean, he's not doing like the extreme stunt work in this one. I mean, it's all like the raw charisma he's like bringing to the screen. It just makes you wonder why he wasn't resonating with American audiences and didn't go on to like become a bigger star of this period than he obviously was in Hong Kong. So it's kind of funny when you watch it. But as I said, it's just you're watching these movies, and as I said, this is all physical, actual proper, stuntmen going out in cars and destroying things. There's insane like helicopter stunts as well. There's a scene where the mafia guys are trying to kidnap the sheik. The whole thing with these races is that it's sort of like a coast-to-coast race, and it's sponsored by this sheik. The films themselves would inspire the Gumball rallies, which we did once when I was back with Kingpin, and it's sort of like we did the one where we were like going through Europe, and it's sort of like really depressing. You're going through like some like backwater villages where people just broke ass broke, and you've got people like screwing for their village in like Ferraris and stuff, and it's like what a spectrum of we're bringing up here. And I believe that there was also the year the Latvian gangsters were like hijacking people and stealing their cars.
I didn't realize I was nostalgic for these movies. Stop,
I
stop,
mean,
stop it.
they're always on and they're always good. So yeah, if you've never seen them, it really puts into focus sort of like when then you go off and like watch the latest trailer for like, Fast X or whatever. And it's all CGI nonsense and stuff, and you just like watch what like actual stuntmen are doing with real car stuff, and it's just got a real charm to it, even if, as I said, it's got, I think I view it kind of like through a very nostalgic sort of haze, because I obviously grew up watching these
I mean,
movies.
these movies were, like I say, I just associate Burt Reynolds with all these movies, but he's not in every movie. But there's, I don't know, Burt Reynolds to me is just this man who's on the TV in the 80s for me, when, before I had videos and things like that, and certainly nothing on demand. But it's also, like you said, it's got Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin and all these people from sort of a generation before. So, Burt Reynolds was a huge freaking star in the 70s and 80s, right? Things like Mean Machine, that was a big deal, wasn't it? And we probably know him. He had that second burst of fame when he did Boogie Nights.
Yeah, which he hated.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. But it resurrected his career. But yeah, so it's got these sort of old stars that were in other movies that I used to watch on a Sunday afternoon as well. So it's kind of brought the past and at the time, very modern. Yeah, I've got to be honest, I'm looking them up to see now if anyone's done any nice 4K updates of them, but they don't seem to. They've just chucked them on
No,
Blu.
no, no.
They've just
It's
chucked them on Blu-ray, haven't they? And
surprising. There is a third one with John Candy, which everyone seems to have forgotten
oh,
about, so.
I didn't know there was. My guess is these things must have rights issues up the yin yang if you wanted to do anything extra with them. But I don't know. Anyway, what
the added appeal though is the fact there's an animated sequence during the finale that was animated by Ralph Bakshi.
Really?
Yep.
Oh mate, I'm
done. He did the little animated arrow like driving across America and then like landing in LA. Obviously Ralph Bakshi, another sort of outlaw artist.
Yeah.
Because in American animation you have the three stars. You have Disney, you have Don Bluth, which is like snarling villains and cigar smoking, and he's like real monstrous sort of creations. He was sort of like the darker Disney. And then you had Ralph Bakshi, who was like Disney if Disney did a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
Who is just like, he's just completely out of he's got kind of both oars out of the water, but instead is equally insanely influential to a lot of people.
Indeed. Okay. Well, other than prepping a show where we look at our favourite 80s movies in the future, what else have you been watching?
Okay, so another one, which also makes it kind of a bonus episode here, is the film New York Ninja. Now, this one's also got a really interesting sort of history to it. This one stars John Louis, who did a bunch of movies in Hong Kong, a lot of sort of like kung fu movies. I'm just trying to think what the sort of things that you may have seen. I mean, he obviously did things like Wu-Tang Magic Kick, Trinity Goes East. Just shout if any of this is standing out. Yeah,
it doesn't, but obviously, trio. Yeah, we spoke about this on a recording at something else, so I'm kind of spoiled because I know what you're talking about now. But at the time, I didn't have a clue. But yeah. you have linked me up with this, and I've yet to watch it.
So basically, he came over to New York and shot guerrilla style this movie called New York Ninja, where he pays a sound guy at a local news station whose girlfriend is horribly murdered. This is all in the first 5 minutes of the film. After telling him that he's going to be a daddy. And she, as I said, because this being 80s New York, she's horribly murdered by the local thug elements. Struggling to deal with his grief, he sets out to become a vigilante and becomes a New York ninja. And when I say ninja, as in he's a ninja in the same way that Storm Shadow is a ninja. It's in he's running around in white ninja garb in the broad daylight, fighting people.
Yeah, so he's taking on the aesthetic, but he's not really a ninja.
He's also basically battling the cast of Streets of Rage, it seems.
Oh.
Because they just seem to be like the most random ass thugs that he's constantly fighting. There's a killer called the Plutonium Killer who apparently has radiation powers. None of this is properly explained. He has a fight on roller skates, again while in ninja garb. And the whole time, his friends at the TV station would be like filming it, and then he'll pop up like Hong Kong Fooey or like Clark Kent or whatever, and they're like, oh, what did I miss? And he's like, you missed the ninja.
So when was this made?
So this was made in the 80s, and the production, he got it all shot, and the production company folded. So it was shoved in a vault, and years later, Vinegar Syndrome found it.
Right.
But they didn't have any audio for it. They just had the footage, like the raw footage. So they hired a director to re-edit it all together, and they redubbed the film. The director they brought in was Curtis Spiegler, who has done films such as Zillafoot and Sheepskin and Devil's Well.
Okay.
And, you know, a bunch of other stuff that you probably never watched. But he does a really phenomenal job in putting this all together. At the same time, they cast it, they redub it all with, like, the who's who of, like, genre cinema royalty. So we have Don the Dragon Wilson. We have Lena Quigley. We have Michael Berryman and Cynthia Rothrock. And it's actually really, it's a bad movie, but it's a bad movie in like the right way, as in, you know, with hearts in it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get what you mean.
And John Liu is obviously a very, you know, accomplished martial artist. The people he's working with, not so much. So so while he's impressive, there's a lot of slack through in this one.
Oh, fantastic.
But I believe it's still available through Vinegar Syndrome, so I would recommend checking it out. And as I said, probably something for a bonus episode at some future date.
Just remind me what it's called. New York Ninja, right?
It's called New York Ninja.
Yeah, I have to.
And at the end, it promises a sequel. Is like the New York Ninja return in L.A. Ninja, which never happened, and instead we got Beverly Hills Ninja,
right?
Which starred Chris Farley, wasn't it?
Oh, I've heard of that. Yes, it is Chris Farley. Oh, I see. Right, yes.
So that's the closest we ever got to L.A. Ninja.
Gotcha. Vinegar Syndrome, there's a funny boutique label.
They are. They're... I appreciate the work that they do, but some of the stuff that they preserve, it's not going to be to old taste.
No, it is the most boutique of boutique, but if they're doing good work and keeping things alive... I'm just having a look at their website now. Yeah, I've got to say, they're not the sort of thing I'd have front and centre in my collection. Although, they've done a 4K of the Amityville Horror. Anyway, carry on. What's next?
So next, obviously, with us, the time we're recording this, we just had May the 4th, which is obviously that day that, you know, the nerd kids get excited about that haven't, like, burned the Star Wars collection because of what Disney have done to it. So, rather fittingly, I watched Message from Space, which is the Japanese cash-in. It's one of two Japanese cash-in, the other one being War in Space. And Message from Space was released in 78, so the year after New Hope comes out, because all the studios were sort of rushing to get their version of Star Wars out. The Italians did one called Laser Blast. But this one's directed by Kinji Fukasaku, who should be a name familiar for yourself, because he did Bowrail.
Of course. I've heard of this movie. My little brain, you probably couldn't hear it, but now I now know the movie you're talking about. I haven't seen it, but I am aware exactly of what you're talking about. Keep going.
Yeah. This is a jumbled mess of a plot that I'm still not sure what's going on. It's kind of like somewhere between, as I said, there's elements of Star Wars in there, and the same way there's elements of Battle Beyond the Stars in there.
Yeah.
Where you have there's this ragtag group being brought together. And as I said, the plot is so bafflingly confusing, I'm not even sure how to really explain it. But the action scenes are really fantastic. The model works fantastic. And they cruise for through the space in a space galleon, as in, you know, the tall ships.
Yeah,
they have one of those. Also, space is something you can swim through.
Of course it is.
So you see people doing breaststroke in space.
Oh god. Oh, that is you're reminding me of the Fifth Doctor episode Enlightenment, where they had ships, literal ships in space that were racing around. So I guess it's a thing. I guess it's a genre thing. Okay.
The cast does include Vic Morrow, as well as Sonny Chiba as a space samurai. That's all I really
Want to... Okay, Sonny Chiba, yeah. And so Vic Morrow.
That's all I really got. Vic Morrow.
Oh, well, okay. Another name. I know Vic Morrow is the guy who had his head chopped off filming the Twilight Zone movie. Yeah, probably not what he wants to be most. Probably not his greatest moment, but yeah. Okay, but yes, okay.
Bad News Bears and Humanoids in the Deep and Rock.
But it sounds to me it's not a movie that you're recommending I watch.
I mean, to watch it once for the experience, but as I said, just don't expect to understand what's going on. It's just bafflingly confusing and really long at the same time. Finally, I've got the Netflix exclusive Kill Box Soon, directed by Byun Sung Hyun.
So this is the half. I'm halfway through this movie.
All right.
So let me hear how you think about it.
Okay. This is a South Korean action thriller, very much in the style of The Villainess. Boksoon is a single mother who has a secret life as a top assassin who finds herself being targeted when the agency she works for decides to turn against her. This is a very stylized film in terms of the action. The the only downside is that the plot is rather lacking and is sort of padded out a lot longer than it needs to be, as this clocks in 137 minutes, which really did feel longer than it needs to be. But at the same time, the action is absolutely fantastic in this film and very stylized. The character of Bok Soon, though, here played by Jun Do-yoon, is again really fantastic. She has this amazing ability where she can sort of play out how different actions are going to happen. So she sort of like has this foresight ability that we see during the opening sequence, where she has a sword fight against a Yakuza boss, and realizing that she's not going to best him in a fight with against his sword with her hatchet, decides just to shoot him instead.
Yeah. So I, like I said, I'm only halfway through it. And basically it was on my list, and then I saw, oh, Elwood's watched that. I bet that's what he's going to talk about. And I was trying this evening to watch it all, so but various reasons, things got in the way. So two things. So Jeon Do-yeon is like one of the greatest actresses in the world. What the fuck is she doing in this this sort of action film? I mean, I guess you might know her from, I mean, she's sort of things like, she's won the Cannes, Best Actress at Cannes. I mean, she's like one of the greatest Korean actresses of all time. What's the fuck is she doing in this silly Korean Netflix movie, action movie? But it's wonderful because she's middle-aged. I mean, she's a good-looking middle-aged lady, but she's not your classic Korean action female action star. And she's brilliant. And like you say, some of the camera work, certainly in the first half, it's really imaginative and interesting. So I went and had a look, the director, Byun Sung-hyun, who didn't ring any bells, but his first film was this film called What You're Wearing, which is also known as My Phone Sex Partner, which is this really great Korean comedy about this couple who basically, it's like a romantic comedy, but they get together because they accidentally have phone sex with each other, which is kind of brave sort of thing for a Korean film. So but I don't remember that film being as cinematically imaginative, visually imaginative. There's a, like you say, even that opening scene sort of, it starts off, you know, kind of stylized, and then part of the action takes place through a moving train. It's hard to explain. And then,
yeah, we basically we're watching the action through as a train passes in front of us,
which that gives you a sort of a feel like you're watching it on a like a Super 8 or something. It's really amazing. And then the camera sort of flips around and you watch the next bit through the reflection in a puddle, which is where you first get this view. I didn't know if this was like some, if she literally, as much as I've seen, she's sort of flashed forwarded a couple of times and watched a few scenarios, but I didn't know if that was actually a power she had or it's just a cinematic trope. But yeah, but you basically see her losing the fight, but in a reflection and a puddle shot upwards, and like she gets decapitated, doesn't she? But it's like, that's just crazy. But at the same time, my view was, yeah, it's a bit like The Villainess. It's a bit like, it reminded me a lot of so much. What's the film? Was it Gunpowder Milkshake, film that came out last year, the year before, where, you know, female, really capable female assassins and their bosses turn on them. That's what it felt like to me. When that film's got Michelle Yeoh in it, hasn't it? Thinking about it.
It does. And that's
it's got Lena Jesse Headley.
Lena Headley.
Yeah,
and it's got Karen Gillan.
And yeah, it's got a fantastic cast. It's okay, but that's the vibes this got to me. But like I said, I'm only halfway through, so I don't know where it's going to go. I just think, what the hell is Jeon Do-yeon doing in this movie? But actually, you're right. From what I've seen, she's fantastic because she can not only act, but she can do the comedy that's required as well. And I think the camera work obviously will do a lot of the heavy lifting in the action. So I'm looking forward to finishing it, but I don't think it's necessarily terribly original. But then that's what you thought about The Villainess, so, and I love that film.
Yeah, I mean, I had my issues with The Villainess. It's been a while since I watched The Villainess, so I need to revisit it at some point. But No, it didn't. Lots of this as much as everyone else did. But at the same time, when you look at how the action scenes are shot here, nothing sort of like that choppy-ness. It so happened I was like watching The Expendables the same night, and you see like the action scenes in that where like Stallone and Stone Cold Steve Austin having a brawl. And it's so up close and choppy. And you look at this one, and like the camera's moving, and you're seeing everything in a pretty wide lens. I mean, it's obviously not going as wide as we see in like the Hong Kong movies, but certainly it's a suitably wide lens that you can really appreciate the action that's happening. And certainly, there is a fight in a restaurant, which is probably one of my favorite action scenes I've seen this year, I think, and one of the sort of stand up moments of the film. Including the finale, where it has the ability to have foresight into the different outcomes, means that you have this sequence where her and her boss are having the multiple versions themselves having showdowns, and it shows like how the different outcomes are sort of like playing out and that. So, yeah.
Yeah. So probably next week or next episode, you'll get my view of this film after I finished it. But yeah, it just looked very, very stylish, though. And I've got to be honest with you, I had it on my watch list for a couple of weeks, ignored it, and I didn't realise who was starring in it. So I would have watched it much sooner if I realised it, because she's like one of my favourite actresses of all time. And just to see her... And I think it's amazing. I think it's just so fantastic. I mean, she's 50 years old, mate. And a Korean actress still acting in top-level films at 50 is almost unheard of. So more power to her. She's brilliant.
Oh. Anything else you've been watching at all? Is that...
I don't think anything that really suits the show, unless you want to hear about who killed the KLF, but I don't think that's really that's another film I love that I watched this week. But I think talking about 90s art dance bands probably aren't what this show's about. But I'd highly recommend it. And the director finished it while in prison. So that's even better.
Okay, so... Tonight, we are obviously talking about I Saw the Devil, a film which has really gained quite the following since its release. And I don't think this was a Tartan release. I think this was an Optimum release, I want to say.
I think you're right. I was watching it on my Blu-ray player. I'm pretty sure it was an Optimum releasing one. Yeah, it was after Tartan died. 2010, this fella, isn't it?
Yep.
Probably sort of Western release about a year later. So, yeah.
Directed by Kim Ji-woon, who is better known for obviously directing films such as Tale of Two Sisters, A Bittersweet Life, Good, the Bad, and the Weird, as well as the Arnold Schwarzenegger vehicle, The Last Stand. And he also did The Foul King. So three movies that we've obviously covered on this show. This now being his fourth appearance on our show.
And probably one of my three favourite directors. Period. So... spoilers about that, whether I like this one or not.
The film itself follows a psychopath called Kyung Chu, who, after killing the fiance of a top secret agent name of Soo Hyun, finds himself caught up in a game of cat and mouse as the hunter becomes the hunted in a series of increasingly violent encounters. This is a film that a lot of people sort of like to sort of warn you about, because it is a little bit grotesque, but at the same time is an incredibly riveting thriller, than one that I'm really glad that I saw and probably wish that I hadn't put off so long, you know, obviously being put off by the people talking about like how grotesque this one was. But the film itself stars Lee Byung-hyun and Choi Myung-sik. Two names that are very familiar to this show. I mean, obviously, Choi Myung-sik was also in Brotherhood, which I'm a fan of, but you're not a fan of Steven, is that right?
Yeah. Not so much. Well, it's all right.
I mean, He's obviously in No Boys, in Lucy's, in Lady Vengeance. It's sort of his credits go on and on. Same with Lee Byung-hun, who was also in like JSA. He was Storm Shadow in G.I. Joe.
Bit of Suite Life. He's the main character in that. I mean, he was he's the secret surprise person that takes their mask off at the end of Squid Game. He's Lee Byung-hun is an international star. I think that's fair to say. Incredibly handsome and all that. And Choi Min-sik is just one of the most interesting South Korean actors. I think he's in Into the Mirror as well, which is another one from those early Tartan days. And he's in...
Crying Fist as well.
Yeah, but he's like this... And he's a real methody guy as well. You know, he's a fascinating... And in this film, he's... amazing. Apparently he's a really nice guy that gets into character, and there's a story that is told where during the filming or just after the film he gets in a lift and there's this woman who sees him and recognizes him, and so she's terrified of him because of how horrible he is in this movie. He says, no, I'm a nice guy really. But yeah, he inhabits roles. He's also a serial killer in Lady Vengeance, isn't he? And he's
That's great. Hideous.
He's hideous in that as well. But yeah, but apparently he's a nice guy and a great actor.
Yeah. So, as I said, this was it's an unusual film, really, in the fact that it's all set up as this sort of revenge thriller, but at the same time, it goes in a very sort of unique direction. So we have this serial killer here called Jang Kyung-joo, who's a real nasty piece of work. He's a school bus driver by day, and by night he sort of preys on unsuspecting female victims who, once he has subdued them, has a real sort of like his main sort of his MO is the fact that he just likes to disembody young women. That's his whole thing. And he likes, and unfortunately his latest victim happens to have a fiance who's also a top secret agent who proceeds in tracking him down.
Yeah, he's a national security agent, isn't he? So he's, you know, he's more than capable of tracking this guy down, which he does very quickly after catching a couple of others on the way.
True, and I think... The film itself could have just been like this one prolonged sort of chase sequence with him trying to track him down and constantly just be missing him. But as you said, he's very efficient at what he does. And the fact that he's given time off work and they're like, you know, you need time to get over the loss of your fiance. And he basically just gets his tools together and sets out on his vigilante mission. He's got his list of suspects. And he quickly starts tracking him down. The first guy adds another one to our penis trauma list because he goes and takes a wrench to his balls.
Yep.
Another guy he runs over with his car. And as I said, he quickly manages to track down the killer responsible and proceeds to beat the living hell out of him. And it's at this point that the film really takes an interesting turn as... while it seems that, you know, he's going to, like, kill this guy, you know, justice be done. Instead, he decides he's going to tag him, although, like, he's like a wild animal. Instead, constantly track him and then randomly turn up at various points to beat him up further. And carries out this campaign of prolonged torture against this serial killer who's constantly trying to wonder why he's being tracked. And at the same time, finding himself on the run as his identity as a killer is being slowly sort of exposed, and along the way sort of like makes stopping with other equally horrific people that he's friends with. So
yeah, I think that character, that sort of the other serial killer cannibal fella, is calls it catch and release. He understands exactly what's going on, that this guy is it's called, you know, he wants to make Kyung-chul suffer and almost not let him off by giving him the release of death. And it's a long movie and it's
dark as hell. It's, although it's not without some charm. So I was, I've had a bit of a complicated relationship with this movie, a bit like the other movie, which I felt was a bit like this. Do you remember? Well, you will remember World of Kanako.
Yes,
which
exactly.
is equally as unrelentingly grim. Although, actually, in some ways, the whole world view of World of Kanako is grim. This one just lives in a grim world where there's a lighter world somewhere else. but so I remember. I go through these sort of liking it, not liking it, loving it, not loving it when I've watched it. And I watched Mark Kermode's radio review of it. And he's a huge fan of other work by Kim Ji-woon, like Tale of Two Sisters. And he hated this film, right? Because I think he saw it as a bit in that sort of post-Eli Roth Hostel torture porn kind of genre. And then if you read the comments underneath, they're all saying, no, you're wrong, Mark, this is brilliant. And that's the kind of I think I go through that, because I hate films like Hostel, even though it has got a Takashi Miike cameo. But I just think they are it's the act of the horror, the bad things is all that these films have got in them. And I get that they're very visceral and everything, but I just don't find them entertaining. And that's sometimes what I feel about this film. But then every time I watch it, it's better. It's way better than that. It's an incredibly well-made serial killer film and revenge thriller film that doesn't necessarily tell us anything new. You know, it's the whole, again, Kermode brings this up, but this is the same as Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, right? You know, if you hunt monsters, you'll become a monster yourself. That kind of Nietzsche thing. And Kermode says, oh, it's just boring and rote. And yes, it is. But I think the fact that our hero is, he's not really a hero, is he? But, you know, our let's just call it our protagonist is so.
Oh, he's a fancy word.
Yeah, he's so capable. I just think that's a really interesting twist, and that this is his way of processing grief. Because we don't find out that his wife was fiance, isn't it? Was it his wife? Fiance doesn't matter. Probably
his fiance.
Wife,
yeah.
Yeah, is pregnant for part of the way through the film, which just adds layers and layers and layers.
Well, she mentions it to him when he's. When he's done a sort of like tied up in his lair and he's starting to do his things, she says to him, "I'm pregnant."
But he pauses for a moment. But Lee Byung-hun doesn't know, so he doesn't. Yeah, so he finds out later that you know he's not only has his wife been killed or his fiance been killed, but she was pregnant, so he's also killed his child. I mean, this must be sort of the most darkest, devastating thing that could happen to someone. And yet he's so skilled, and he's also got, you know, he's got the help of colleagues and people who are turning a blind eye to some of his activities and things, aren't they? I just think it's a really interesting twist. And then Kyung Chul is so fucking repulsive as well. And I really also liked, you know, like you said, that he met up with his other kids. I mean, it's like, well, yeah, he not only has this mate who's a cannibal who he hangs out with for a bit, but in another bit of the film, he gets away and is basically picked up by one of the other serial killers that was on the list of who it could be, and he ends up killing him as well. So it's like there's this is like subculture where all these people are hanging together. And this is kind of something that's explored, you know, like in Neil Gaiman's Sandman, there's like that serial killer convention where all the serial killers sort of go to and their heroes go to. And in American Horror Story has this whole thing in a couple of the series where all these people like the son of Sam and they're like, they all know each other and they all hang out for dinner and stuff like that. I love that aspect of it, is that all the really grim people in the world probably travel in the same circles and probably know each other. It's a small world after all, isn't it? But I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, The Following's another example of that with a serial killer cult. It adds a certain sense of I don't want to say realism to it, but it makes it have a little more sort of depth to it. The fact that if you're a serial killer, then you kind of like, it would make sense you'd be drawn to other killers. And then at the same time, all killers have their own different MOs. They have different things that they're into. The thing I really like about this film is that it's essentially taken in many ways. That you've got this guy with a very special set of skills who is going to use them to get the job done. In this case, obviously tracking down this serial killer. And more so the fact that he's not... His lust for revenge isn't sated in the fact that, you know, he catches the guy, he beats him up, he breaks his hands. The fact that he has to, like, constantly let him go and then capture him again. And the whole time, you would have thought that Kyung Cho would be wising up the fact that he wouldn't just be continuing to commit crimes at every given opportunity. There's a very uncomfortable attempted rape sequence in this film, which was probably one of the few things that I sort of struggled with in the film. And that's because, you know, sexual violence is never fun.
Is that with the schoolgirl?
It's with the nurse.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yes, that whole sequence. But he also, he also captures a schoolgirl. He tries to rape a nurse. And there's the weird thing as well with the girlfriend of the cannibal who he starts fucking. Yeah. And I believe so this film was, I think the version we've seen is known as the international cut, which is different to the Korean cut. So in Korea it had to have like about 40-50 seconds cut out of it, and I believe whilst he was cutting it for the violence and sort of the things that we just talked about, he did change the film, not necessarily for the violence for the rest of the world, but sort of change the focus. And I think there's a like a couple of scenes missing which explain that relationship with that woman that he starts shagging in the kitchen of the cannibal. Like it was a known affair or something, because she's a bit fucking weird, because she's obviously getting off on hanging around really dangerous men. So, but that's a bit. But that thing with the nurse is, it's horrible because you don't expect to see that in a Korean movie. It is uncomfortable. But hey, he gets well beaten up and he has his Achilles ripped open, so in a very unpleasant manner. So yeah.
Yeah, and we also have the scene later on where he stumbles across another killer.
Mm.
When he gets in the taxi and they pick up another killer and it's sort of like...
But that killer is one that we... You know, at the beginning... Lee Byung-hun's character finds out there's like four people that it could be, and he gets rid of two of them quickly, and one of them is obviously Kyung Chul, but the fourth one is the guy in the back of the car. That's what I just love, the fact that they Kyung Chul ends up killing him, doesn't he? Very violently. But yes, I just love the fact that it all came together, and even though it's a film which is like nearly 2.5 hours long, there's not a lot of fat in it. There's not a lot of extraneous stuff. There's one thing I don't like, but apart from that, everything has a meaning and a reason. It's quite economic, even though it's quite lengthy and grim.
Definitely so, and I think it's also shot with such a visual flair to it. It's almost comparable in many ways to Fincher's Seven. While Seven's obviously much more of a sort of straightforward detective procedural, but just a killer with a fancy MO. This one, as I said, is much more, goes down the path of revenge. It's kind of like if they just like basically follow Brad Pitt's character needed and to have Morgan Freeman's character to sort of like calm him down and keep him on track. It's sort of like, what happens if we put like a character who's so enveloped by wrath, and we just put him on this collision course with the person who killed his fiance? It's all like, what would happen? And that's the real sort of focus here. And I think, yes, we could obviously argue that it falls into that sort of torture porn category of like Eli Ross Hostel and Snuff and, you know, the host of films which sort of followed in its wake in that sort of like 2000 period. But at the same time, it's not about the prolonged sort of torture sequence. It's more just the fact that horrible things are done to people, but it's never shot with sort of, and it's shot with a lot of visual flair, but it never feels that it's shot with like a voyeuristic edge to it, which is obviously so key to the torture porn genre, really.
And I think that's where I disagree with Commode, because I think Commode was putting, you know, those torture porn films are voyeuristic, right? And they're about the depths people go to, but at the same time, look at the crazy special effects we can do. Saw is another one that's like, the movies are nothing, but they're all about those special scenes where something horrible happens to someone. But I didn't think that was the case here. You know, the people that are getting hurt are either, you know, it's showing what an arsehole our antagonist is, but also trying to get some kind of revenge for what he does to people on him. I didn't think it was voyeuristic in that way, but it's very stylish. I mean, it's not as gorgeous as Tale of Two Sisters, but it's got, I know, Kim Ji Woon's just got a lovely visual style. I mean, just, it's this, Tale of Two Sisters, you know, we, Better Sweet Life was really well filmed. Good, the Bad, the Weird, another film that we'll probably talk about one day. The guy has got a fantastic aesthetic. And we often talk about Park Chan-wook, you know, being very visually interesting in his films. But I think Kim Ji-woon is in some ways even better. Every scene in this film is beautiful, however gross what we see is might be going on in it. It's very similar to World of Kanako in that sense, isn't it?
Yeah, the thing I wanted to really sort of question with this is the fact that Soo Hyun is obviously on this path of revenge, and when we look at other films where we have characters on the path of revenge, especially within Korean cinema, such as like Bittersweet Life, Lady Vengeance, Old Boy to an extent, these characters all have to pay a price for getting to have their revenge. And it doesn't feel that he ends up having to really sort of pay any sort of penalty, really, for engaging in these sort of very primal desires of just wanting to get revenge and the things that he does. It's sort of like he doesn't feel like there's any sort of real comeuppance here. He even manages to sort of a fancy kill at the end of his serial killer victim.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, when he finally dies, and yes, it is kind of a fun eventuality. So he, you know, I think I said at the beginning, you know, there's this whole, you'll become a monster if you chase monsters, look into the abyss, the abyss looks back at you, all those kind of things are there. And he doesn't, actually all he gets at the end is relief. He is let go. You know, he personally has the grief, he has the memories of the people that he's lost. But yeah, you would expect from a Confucian director, right? So someone from Korea, probably brought up in the Confucian tradition, you would expect maybe them both to die, and that doesn't happen here, which is interesting. My only feeling of a misstep, and it kind of linked to that, is that his sister-in-law and father-in-law are also killed at the end of this film. Sorry, spoilers. And I felt that utterly unnecessary, and that was cruel, and had no... I mean, the idea is to show that Min Suk's character does gain some kind of upper hand once he realises who's after him and stuff like that. But I didn't like that. I didn't find that necessary. I mean, there were characters which didn't really interact with our hero directly, only on the phone and stuff like that. In fact, it took me a while to realize that was her sister. I didn't know who this woman was. You know, it took me a couple of watches and reading up to work out who it was. But yeah, I don't know, there's just maybe a lack of lesson here. Not that everything has to be a sitcom with a here's the teaching moment at the end, but it did feel a little after such a long journey that there wasn't anything other than, right, I can get on and grieve now.
Yeah, it does sort of like bucks the trend in many ways, because you certainly look, even in sort of like Western cinema, when we look at The Vigilante, the either like go out in a sort of like blaze of glory, as we see with like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, or Kevin Bacon's character in Death Sentence, the fact that they end up being like killed as part of their final revenge. But even like when you look at something like Charles Bronson's like Death Wish movies, he ends up really sort of being exiled from each town that he goes into. He's always like having to start over in a new town at the end of the film when he's finished like mowing down countless scumbags. Never the people responsible, but always like every other scumbag in the area.
All scumbags are up for grab. But yes, it's that is the... I think especially as an Asian film, I think we are used there to be... that there's usually a message or a story or something to be taught, a teaching moment. I mean, that's a very facetious thing to say, isn't it? We usually say that sarcastically. But yeah, it was a bit weird. And I hadn't, until you really mentioned it then, I hadn't really thought about it. But yes. Yeah,
when you look at every Bruce Lee movie, he normally ends up being like arrested or gunned down.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the common thing. You know, once you've become that monster, you can't live, can you? You know, how does he come back from that after what he's done to that guy? And he's, you know, and he's shit on that guy's family as well. I mean, they were pricks, right? He basically got them to kill their son.
Yeah, I mean, this is the ultimate revenge, really, isn't it? Because, I mean, the whole film, he's breaking this guy down. Every encounter he has, he's, like, messing him up in some way. So the first time he breaks his arm, next time we see him, he's going to cut his tendons. So this Zuka is like being slowly hobbled with each encounter that he has. And as you say, it's this bait and release technique. Catch and release, isn't it? So,
yeah, catch and release is what they call it, yeah.
And that's really sort of the real hook of the film. And I think it depends on if you can buy into the idea of this revenge story where it's about constantly... torturing this person that you're trying to take revenge on, rather than just like having to like battle your way up to finally getting your revenge. I think then that there's a lot to obviously enjoy in the film, and the fact that it's so stylishly shot. This is a really beautiful film to look at, which in kind of bizarre saying, as soon as it's filled with so many grotesque imagery in it, such as like seven body parts. And we have that scene where they find the body parts and you have all the press like swarming in, and I thought that's such a fantastically shot sequence, but really says a lot about crime scene preservation in Korea.
Yeah. Well, I think we've watched plenty of films.
Stomping all over the place.
We've watched plenty of films where the Korean police is, they're not so good. It reminds me of, like I say, that so Lady Vengeance absolutely has that kind of concept as well, which women sick again. Memories of Murder, yeah. The Korean police aren't used to dealing with this shit, are they?
No. It's Memories of Murder is that small town police has never had a murder, it seems like.
Yeah,
they had absolutely. The farmer driving through the bloody crime scene. There's something about this film, as I said, it's as grotesque as it is, and there's moments which are certainly uncomfortable to watch. I did thoroughly enjoy this film. I thought it was a really phenomenal piece of filmmaking, and makes me wonder why, when we talk obviously about the sort of like key directors of Asian cinema, why Kim Ji-woon is not more part of the conversation. I mean, obviously, people like Seon Sono, Takashi Miike, Park Chan-wook, these are also like directors we know by name, and then you have some like Kim Ji-woon, who's done key pieces of cinema, especially in like Korean cinema. These are films such as I said, like Tale of Two Sisters, Bittersweet Life, Good, the Bad, and the Weird, even like The Quiet Family.
Fantastic. So I think, to be fair, Kim Ji-woon, Park Chan-wook, and Bong, those three. You know my conspiracy theory of how the Korean government have taken over culture. When I first was exploring Korean cinema knowingly, sort of in that post J horror boom, you know, I had some I got some stuff from like the Korean cultural thing in London, and those three directors were very much at the forefront, and they were the three directors who, well, certainly Kim Ji-woon and Park Chan-wook got to work in the States. I quite like The Last Stand, his Schwarzenegger film, by the way.
It's good.
I think it's a bit of an unheralded gem. And I think he makes these films, he makes his versions of genre films. A Bittersweet Life is his version of a gangster movie. Good, the Bad, the Weird is like his version of a Western. Tale of Two Sisters is his horror story. This is his version of a serial killer film. They're quite genre type films, but he does his own version of them. There's a brilliant short film called Coming Out, which is a vampire story. So it's done before this, and it's amazing. I was lucky enough to see it in London. They showed three of his short films, Coming Out, his segment in Doomsday Book, and another one which I can't remember. And he was there and gave a talk, and he's obviously a nice guy as well. But I think he's really interesting. What I will say is, I haven't seen any of his latest films, even though I'm a huge fan. So I haven't seen Age of Shadows. I haven't seen Wolf Brigade. And I've just seen he's got a new one out this year called Cobweb, which looks fantastic as well. So I think I'll be rediving in. But I do think he is, with Park Chan-wook, with Bong, I think they are the big three. But I know what you mean, because I don't think, you know, as hard as I've worked on trying to get people to watch Tale of Two Sisters, it probably isn't. They aren't as well known as Old Boy, are they? They aren't as well known as Parasite, so.
Maybe. Yeah, it's a shame, really. I mean, certainly films such as like Tale of Two Sisters and Bittersweet Life in particular. Every time we mention like Bittersweet Life, you're still like, it's like, why are more people not talking about this? We should totally cover this. And I remember we covered it on the show, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And we will cover A Good, the Bad, the Weird. That's just a fantastic movie. And again, kind of just shows what a fantastic filmmaker is. He's got an aesthetic sense. He knows how to move the camera. And he's never flashy, I would say. It's just the right thing, you know. Whereas sometimes Park Chan-wook is a bit guilty of doing something flashy, of doing something incredibly memorable for a scene, but maybe not the entire film. I sometimes think, certainly Park Chan-wook is sometimes style over substance. I know I'm a bit alone in that thought, but and obviously Bong's, all his films are about the underclass and the undertrodden, whereas yeah, Kim Ji-woon I think is the director that loves movies, and that's why Cobweb, his latest one, is about a director making a movie and dealing with censorship. Do you think? Wonder where he got that idea from, mate.
I think as well that of the three Asian westerns that we had, I think The Good, Bad, and the Weird is definitely one of the strongest of the three. Because obviously Hong Kong gave us Let the Bullets Fly. Mm-hmm. Japan, we obviously had Miike's Western Django.
Mm.
Obviously with Korea, we had The Good, Bad, and the Weird. And while it's a long movie, I still think it's a very good movie, and this is coming from someone who doesn't like westerns, but I really like the eastern westerns for some reason.
Oh, we're gonna have something to talk about on the when we talk about Kill Bill 2 on another show soon, if you don't like westerns.
Scott knows my opinions on Kill Bill Volume 2 already, so.
But yes, an amazing film. I'm really glad we got to rewatch it, and I'm glad you've broken your I Saw the Devil virginity. Popped your devil cherry.
I finally crossed it off the watch file. Yeah.
I was really surprised to find out you hadn't watched it. That was the most surprising thing of all.
I was very surprised that it didn't win our Halloween vote, to be honest. Because I was so sure that when we put it up for the vote that it was going to be like the film that was going to win the vote. And instead we ended up doing Dream Home, which was very good in its own respect, but as I said, it was always in the back of my mind. It's sort of like, you know, really got to see I Saw the Devil, because so many people have like talked about it yourself. Team member Steph has talked about it. The guys from a kissing contest have like said it, and Junk Food Dinner have also gave it sort of like rave reviews as well. So it was always a film that I was sort of keen to see, and I said the good thing obviously about doing this show is the fact that it forces you to finally cross some stuff off the watch pile because you have a reason to watch it. So I think so many times you have stuff in your watch pile and it's all like, oh, I'm going to set up the situation in which I'm going to watch this film. And obviously by sometimes just having someone to, something to give you the nudge that you need to get things done. And that's obviously the good thing about what we do. For ourselves,
absolutely.
At least, anyway.
Yeah,
done about the greater good, but... But, yeah, as I said, if you don't mind some rather squeamish filmmaking, this is a really fantastic film and a great companion piece, as I said, to the likes of Bittersweet Life or Seven. Or if you want to see like a really violent version of Taken, this is probably going to be right up your alley.
So, absolutely.
Big recommendation from us both. And on that note, it brings us to the end of tonight's show. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to us. Leave us a review, as it all helps raise the profile of the show. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Come say hi to us there. And you can also check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. Stephen, it's your turn to pick next.
Bullheader. I'd already decided after this all this violence we were going somewhere very artsy.
We've created our own I Saw the Devil situation now, haven't we? It's just like
we have. Yeah, drum. Yeah. So I'm gonna chase you down with art house films now and then force you to watch it. But I'll think of you know exactly where I'm going with we're gonna be watching Edward Yang films. Anyway, so this I think this is a film you're aware of. I don't think you've seen it.
Okay.
But I would be very interested in your thoughts of it. But I do apologise in advance because I really don't think it's your cup of tea. But on the other hand, I think you might get a kick out of it. So let's see. So it is a Taiwanese film, obviously, because that's where all my favourite art house films come from. A director I don't think we've covered yet, but a director that's very well thought of. So Hu Hsiao-hsien. I mean, you did surprise me because you liked Goodbye Dragon Inn, didn't you? Which,
yes.
You tricked me by enjoying that. So,
oh, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I'm really happy you enjoyed it. I just didn't expect you to. And what I'm going to... Yeah, so Hu Hsiao-hsien is not a director I've watched a lot of. He is a bit of a slow cinema kind of guy. But I enjoy everything I've seen. I want to go back to 2016. And his film The Assassin, starring Xu Kui. So again, someone you'll be very familiar with. The Assassin is a wuxia film, but done through a very art house lens and is very elliptical. And it's a film I haven't watched since 2016 when it came out, so I'm looking forward to meeting it again. It is a film that is beautiful, but it's a film whose style I think is going to be very challenging for us both. However, let's give it a go because I think a lot of our audience probably are very aware of this film and be interested in what we're going to say about it.
Yeah, it's one I'm aware of. As I said, I think it's been on my watch pile as well.
So. I think we've spoken about it before, and I've probably threatened you with it before. But
I think it's also just come off iPlayer as well.
Oh no, just come off it. Oh no.
Oh, Channel 4. I'm sure it was sitting on one of those free players. So
yeah, well, you can get a free trial of Studio Canal Presents through Prime. That's a way of watching it.
That's obviously coming up on our next episode. Thank you as always for listening. Thank you to my co-host Stephen.
Pleasure as always, sir.
And we'll be back next time to talk about The Assassin. But until then, good night. Hey! 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 Kinono-koi-wa-wasurete 昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕け散っても星が燃えて落ちても踊り
り続けていたい夜なのさ。胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える思いを狂わすのさ。昨日の恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.